Tremendous challenges and opportunities exist right now for our nation's water infrastructure. In this podcast, the industry's top leaders and innovative minds share their knowledge and insights for ensuring our water systems are operating safely and efficiently. These discussions are designed to motivate and create vibrant 21st century water systems and the innovative workforce required to lead and operate them. This is 21st Century Water with your host, AquaSite founder and CEO, Mahesh Lunani.
So good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I have with me today Glenn Marsloff, General Manager and CEO of Delco Water. Glenn leads a very fast-growing, member-owned utility that's serving across 8 counties. With more than 25 years in the water sector, he's helping guide Delco through a major expansion, regional collaboration, and proactive efforts around water quality, supply resiliency, and innovation. Today, I'm going to dive into his leadership journey and the challenges he's trying to address in this growing region and what's ahead for one of Ohio's most recognized water providers. Well, good morning, Glenn.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on today. I'm really excited about the chance to be on 21st Century Water. I've listened to a lot of the podcasts. I know we're acquainted with a lot of your previous guests, so great stories on here. Hopefully, I can add to legacy of 21st Century Water for you.
No, you sure will. I want to get right into it. You obviously have a background in civil engineering with 25 years into it. What drew you into this space, and more particularly, what led you to become the CEO and general manager at Delco Water?
You couldn't replicate it if you tried from the beginning, right? It's, for those that are faith-based, a series of things that happened very intentionally from the outside that drove me to where I am today. But I grew up here in Central Ohio, went to Ohio State, and really was focused on transportation. When I went through the civil engineering field, I was very successful in the water resources classes and everything, but didn't do that initially as a career. I went to work for my hometown in Hilliard, where I grew up, and transportation primarily. Also did a lot of drainage and some water, wastewater, kind of supported the public service team, was kind of their technical advisor, and working on I&I projects, working on a couple water line replacements. But the way the satellite communities in Central Ohio work is City of Columbus does most of the utilities for them on their behalf. And that was the case with Hilliard. So I spent 10 years there. I got my professional engineer's license and I wanted an opportunity for leadership. And I just didn't see that within the Hilliard makeup, just kind of how the things were. There was a couple mid-level engineers between me and the director spot. So ended up leaving and going down to the Gulf Coast of Florida, to Sarasota as the assistant city engineer, still focused primarily on transportation. And shortly after I arrived there, hit the Great Recession. And the whole entire state of Florida, they're so dependent on real estate as one of their primary ways that they get income. So that the economy just was in terrible condition. And the city, in order to fix some things, they were moving some things into the enterprise funds, including the entire engineering department was folded into public works at the time. And I was given the opportunity to lead what they called utility field operations at the time. So I'm 35 years old, still pretty young in my opinion. And all of a sudden I've got a team of 80, 90 people working for me, almost all of which were older than me, more experienced than I was. But there was great culture within the utilities folks. And it just opened my eyes to the value of the services that water and waste provide. When I was doing transportation, it was really kind of exciting to start a project and finish a project. And there's your life's work actually down in concrete and asphalt, and you're making lives better. But when I got introduced to utilities when I was down in Sarasota, the day-to-day delivering the most important services to folks that they absolutely cannot live without, it changed my entire perspective. Eventually, I got promoted to take over running the entire water, wastewater, reclaimed water utility there in Sarasota. They were all reporting up through me. And great culture there, with a little bit of challenge at the leadership level. There had been some challenges within the utility with city council in the past. So it was pretty difficult to navigate a career down there. And we missed home. We missed raising our sons. We have 3 sons, my wife, Ann, and I. And we missed raising our sons here in the Midwest. So we were looking to get back to Ohio. And this Delco job opened up, and I was fortunate enough to get selected from the outside to become the 4th general manager here at Delco Water.
Well, excellent. It's a great story. You went from Ohio to Florida, and at 35 years old, you had over 70, 90 engineers and got promoted. And that's a great experience right at that age. So now that you were at Delco, it is growing because you serve over 8 counties. Can you give us numbers of the growth and how you're planning for this growth and what's driving the growth?
we were founded in 69, but we started service in 74, right? So we're a little bit over 50 years old at this point. And we started with the USDA Rural Development. It was called Farmers Home Administration at the time, but as a rural utility, right? The groundwater here in Delaware County, so we're one county north of Columbus, Franklin County, which is, of course, the state capital. So we're one county north of them. But at the time, it was a very rural county. And because of the poor groundwater, many of our residents lived on cisterns, right? One of our founders actually drove a water hauling truck. It was part of his career. He was a farmer. He drove a water hauling truck and really saw the need for a central water system. And because the county wouldn't step up and do it, and none of the cities wanted to extend service out into the townships, into the countryside, they started a cooperative. The same principles of the way the nation's rural electrification started with rural electric co-ops in the 1920s and 1930s. That was how our founders founded Delco Water, a rural water cooperative. And us, along with our partners, the Delaware County Regional Sewer District, created the ability to develop Delaware County. And I told you, we're just one county away from the capital and the Ohio State University and everything that happens down in Franklin County. So it pretty quickly developed into a bedroom community for the Columbus region. And our growth was exceptional in the 90s and early 2000s up to the Great Recession. And since then, it's been more manageable. We're growing at 2,000 new population per year or so right now. So it's allowed us to be pretty intentional with how we do our planning. I've already mentioned the background of a co-op, but really is a sensational way to govern a utility. You've got the advantage of being agile and nimble, like an investor-owned utility. We're not governed by our higher revised code. We're very intentional what projects we bid and which ones we assign. We have great partners that we can develop long-term relationships. You know, so we have a couple of pipeline contractors on retainer, and they know how to work for us, and they're very intentional about doing a good job, right? Because we keep using them as long as they continue to perform. It allows us to be a little more, I don't want to say lax in our inspection, but we're confident that they're doing a good job, and we don't have to have a resident inspector on site. We visit with them daily, and that kind of stuff. So right. So it's a very effective way to do it. And then the fact that we are service-oriented to our members, and it's a nonprofit, we still serve the end user. We're not paying a dividend to investors, to stockholders, anything like that, right? We are member-owned. We are service-oriented. Our core values actually spell out the word service, right? So we are all about serving our members, and we think that this governance structure makes us very effective in how we carry it out. So this eight-county region, you know, we're continuing to look at ways to be effective in expansion. You know, we have acquired and consolidated several municipally owned utilities over the years. Where it makes sense, we'll step in and help folks. Where it doesn't make sense and where they don't want us, we try not to get in folks' way that way. But we have found a great opportunity to acquire a couple of big municipally owned systems. And now we're looking for the future. We have several big projects on the horizon.
Yes. Well, clearly you started with one, and then through this cooperative model, you are expanding and consuming multiple municipal-owned utilities into your model. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a strategy of growth. Now, talk about a little bit about infrastructure. You have number of elevated tanks, you got towers, treatment plants, capacity. Can you put in numbers just the size of the utility that you are today?
The cooperative started in the southern part of Delaware County and has since grown to become the largest single retail distribution area in the state of Ohio. We cover about 830 square miles over eight counties. Primarily, we cover Delaware, Morrill, and Marion counties, significant portions of those, and smaller portions of five other counties. And do we manage our growth the same way other utilities do, right? We have a master plan. In fact, our last master plan was done in-house by our deputy general manager. He's since retired, but he was also our chief engineer. And during COVID, he had some time to work from home, and we said, well, why don't you work on this? So that's what he did. And he did a very specific master plan, looked at every single parcel of reasonable size and tried to identify what was likely to go in there, what was the likely timeline for development of that. So it was very specific, much better job than most consultants do for us, because we know our utility better than consultants do. So we have a new area of focus, and that's potential industrial users. We are, by and large, residential, single-family residential. We do have a lot of condominium complexes, and we have some apartments that have come online here in the last 5 years, 10 years, but by and large, single-family residential. And now we've got Amazon Web Services planning on locating on here, and we've had a couple other significant data centers and potentially some other users were going to come onto our system. So one of the tactics we're using is areas that we think are likely to lead to some kind of industrial growth or any kind of growth in an area that we don't have robust service. We're pre-engineering transmission lines out there, right? So rather than wait for someone to come and knock on the door and say, oh, we'd like to build this development out here on this timeline, we're pre-engineering it and we're acquiring the easements and right-of-ways necessary, and we'll have it reasonably available, shovel-ready on the shelf, and build it if somebody comes in and says, yes, we're ready to move out here in this area, Sunbury, that kind of stuff, and then we might be ready to act on that. So we got 3 or 4 projects that we're doing the early engineering on.
Good. Go ahead.
I have another big tactic that we're working on, right? So we have significant capacity here at our largest water treatment facility, what we call the Olentangy plant. And we're working on several transmission line projects to take this available capacity and transmit it where it's needed. We have enough capacity today and for the next decade plus or so, assuming we can get the water where it's needed. So we're really very intentionally trying to find ways. In fact, we have one project right now where we're actually designing a transmission line that will go around one of our other plants, which will both help augment that plant, but also help us with redundancy. So we can take that one down and expand it and not have to worry about keeping it in operation 24/7, 365, as you typically need to do. So we're doing that. One of the advantages we have is we're a newer utility, right? We have acquired a few municipal utilities that have older infrastructure, and we've done some reinvestment there already. But by and large, we have very reliable infrastructure. So it's given us a time to put in, hopefully, what's going to lead to be a very robust asset management system. So when it does come time to reinvest in our pipelines and our plant projects, we're going to have a great data set. We're really going to understand appropriate timing, appropriate remedies for this infrastructure when it comes time to do that. So that's something that we're blessed. I know most of the municipally owned utilities, and just general utilities around the nation, are really dealing with aging pipelines and so much reinvestments needed just to keep the current system in operation. That's not our case. Absent of a dig-in by a contractor working on our system, line breaks and line leaks are fairly rare. So we're forcing it that way.
Right. Clearly, I mean, it sounds to me like you're got pre-ready infrastructure. If businesses and industrial users wants to come in and set their shop, you're almost ready to go. And that's the kind of future you're trying to create here at Delco Water. I want to talk about rates and financial strategies. Can you walk me through, just given it's a cooperative arrangement, how do you have your rate structure and how do you drive conservation using an innovative rate structure?
So one of the blessings of being a nonprofit cooperative is we're not governed by the PUCO, right? We have a 9-member elected board who are very engaged in governing this utility, and it gives us the ability to set rates and make changes on our own. And we have just this month, Mahesh, we finished what is a more traditional arrangement you see here in the Midwest, which is a declining block rate. And we've gone to an inclining block rate, which is, you know, similar to what you see in the South and the West in the U.S. It's very, very uncommon in Ohio and the Midwest to see this. And our challenge is we have a very affluent customer base and our seasonal water demand is significant. That peak day related to lawn sprinkling drives all of our infrastructure investment for storage, source, transmission, treatment capacity, right? That is what dictates it to us. So we switched to this inclining block rate very intentionally to, just like you would see in the West, right? One of our goals for the future, one of our sources is conservation. If we can trim that peak day down, and if we can continue to get our customer base to use water differently, well, our existing infrastructure might last a decade or more longer before we have to invest in new sources and new treatment capacity. And it's unbelievable the expense the capital is costing today. Just 5 years ago, with probably 40 to 60% of the cost of what it would take today to build pipelines and to build particularly treatment, it's so pricey. The city of Columbus is getting ready to spend over $1 billion on their new plant. So we couple this inclined block rate. The first 4,000 gallons, and that's about our typical average wintertime demand, is still at the lowest rate, and we think it's very affordable. Our typical water bill would be in the $30 range. So very affordable. We have great members. Our delinquency on bills is amongst the lowest in the nation. In fact, I would say that our write-off, it's almost unbelievable. We'll write off $15,000 to $20,000 on $26-28 million. And that just is the quality of the members that we have. And in fact, we do work with a couple partners. We work with a local nonprofit called People in Need. And we help them fund lifeline assistance, right? So it's not an ongoing affordability rate that we have in there. But if folks get in some kind of a bad situation, People in Need will help bail them out once or twice per year. I don't know exactly the parameters of that relationship, but they do that for us. We try to stay in our lane. We try to do what we do and do what we do well. And we don't want to try to figure out if somebody qualifies for low income or if their particular hardship qualifies for that. So we bring in partners that do things well and help us out. So that's an example of that. Another thing that we do that I'm not sure is always done across the nation, even though I think American Water Works would suggest this is best practice, but we try to charge a true system development capacity fee up front. So our tap-in fee for a single-family residential home is, I think it's $4,600 plus $800 for the actual meter cost to take that and install that. So that way, our intention is for growth to pay for growth, right? So we have a pretty significant investment account right now that is dedicated to growth. And we have all this growth-related infrastructure. We can spend all these funds, right? They're all accounted for and they're all assigned to projects moving forward. But by charging that true system development fee tap-in cost initially, it allows for growth so our existing members aren't supplementing the cost for a new development to go in somewhere.
Yeah, great innovation. And sounds like the structure of your organization allows you to think about both the inclining block rate as well as the system development one-time fees for any new members coming into your system. I want to talk about, you got 800 square miles, 4 treatment plants, huge swing in demands between summer and winter, which means the water can sit in those pipes, which means water quality is critical. So what is it you're doing on the water quality treatment innovations to ensure you got the treatment and kind of water quality expected by your members?
Well, this is one that's in progress, but we do a pretty good job focusing on our plant treatment capabilities. We expanded our largest one, the Olentangy plant, from 19 to 29 million gallons per day back in 2020. That went live. And we added ultraviolet disinfection as an example to deal with the potential cryptosporidium. We've never had that here in our system, but it's not uncommon here in the Midwest. So we thought we would take advantage of that expansion opportunity to do that. One of our board members actually I told you we have a very engaged board. They truly make our utility better in the way they govern us and the way they lead us. We travel regularly to the Water Pro Conference from National Rural Water Association and to CoBanks events. And our then president back in 2018 went to a session at the Water Pro Conference on PFAS and came back and said, we should check this out. And I felt very confident at the time. I said, we have checked it out. We went through our own testing regimen with UCMR 5 or 4. I can't remember which one it was. Back in 2014, we tested and we had all non-detects throughout our area. But at his request, I kind of did a little bit of research and I said, well, the testing methodology has gotten more precise. Potentially, you know, we might see something. So we actually started testing back in our watershed back in 2019, 2020, and did find kind of what you might expect within a lot of the surface water in our nation, that we have small levels, what we think are small levels. This is well before the health advisory level was changed, but we started testing for this. But we were seeing running averages in 3.5 to 4.5 parts per trillion and engaged Arcadis slightly before that health advisory level to help us work to find treatment. And it took us quite a while to go through the design and permitting, but Ohio EPA has recently authorized us to change out our rapid sand filters back here with full depth monomedia activated carbon. So sometime this year in 2025, we intend to install that project, which will deal with PFAS, also help us with disinfection byproducts. You know, when you have a large distribution system, you're talking about water quality within a distribution system, water age is a concern, right? So we think this is going to go a long way to address both of those challenges. We also have taste and odor compounds occasionally with algae that this should remedy. So we're excited about that project. We hope that that will start construction in 2025. That'll be a big game changer for us. And then whenever we upsize our other surface water plant, we'll probably add similar treatment technology there as well.
Got it. That's excellent because it sounds like you're really moving forward in terms of investment in addressing both the distribution issues as well as the treatment issues. I want to talk about source water resiliency. When we were researching, I couldn't believe it, you have 2.6 billion gallons of above-ground reservoirs in your system. How exactly are you managing that, and how do you use that as a way to offset, hedge against any kind of major demand upswing or drought condition?
So here in the Midwest, in central Ohio, we are near the top of the watershed. So if you go very much further north than us, then cross over the Great Lakes Divide and the rivers start flowing north to Lake Erie. And probably everyone's heard of the Great Lakes Compact, but we cannot acquire anything that's in the Great Lakes watershed. So what we find ourselves with is, even though we get a lot of rainfall annually, our rivers and streams are small, so not reliable. So the two choices are, you either dam up a river and you create a significant impoundment, or you have to store it offline because the river's not going to be reliable by itself. Well, back in the 70s, when our utility started, we simply didn't have the kind of funding that would be necessary to acquire ground for an entire valley in order to dam up the Olentangy River. So we started with upground reservoirs, right? So we have offline storage. We've got a couple of low service buildings. We pump waters out of the rivers when there is adequate capacity in them. And we store it on our upground reservoirs to utilize when we need that water. That was the original tactic, right? So as we've grown, we've added more of these things and they work in series. And it has been a real brilliant mistake, I would say, the way this thing functions, right? So here at our Olentangy plant, we've got about 1.6 billion offline storage, and we pump water out of the river, depending on time of year and demand. You know, it varies a little bit, but it's essentially about a year's worth of storage back in a reservoir system. So we got that type of a buffer off the river. So it provides us a very consistent source water into our plant, right? We don't worry about turbidity in the river. We don't worry about, you know, quick changes in pH or anything. It's a very consistent as it enters the treatment plants. And that buffer, it also allows us to be very selective in what we pump. So we very intentionally don't pump right after we believe farmers may have put fertilizer on their crops, as an example. Right. If we get a call from the EMA that says, hey, we had a tanker spill down here, we simply turn off the pumps because we already have the storage in the reservoirs. We let that go by. We feel adequately that the water quality has been restored, and we turn it back on. We also have a couple of online sensors that are always monitoring for things like nitrates, that type of stuff. So we want to keep the amount of nutrients to our reservoirs at a minimum. And then we also control the quality of the water within the reservoir. We have a whole team. It's not a big team. It's two folks that work full-time on it, but we have a watershed team that look at quality. They're doing things like, we have ultrasonic devices that we've added to deal with, you know, or at least reducing the amount of algae growth we have back there. Occasionally, we'll need to treat it with copper sulfate, something like that, to take good care of it. But the fact that we know that every single drop in that reservoir system eventually is going to flow through our treatment plants, you know, we can proactively treat and make sure that we're keeping that at a high-quality level. And we've never had any issues with harmful algae.
Which is big. Well, it sounds to me like this reservoir is a boon, not only from a resiliency point of view and redundancy, but it gives you a consistent water quality coming into your treatment plant, so you don't have to keep fluctuating your treatment technologies.
That's very true. And I would say we would certainly trade it if we could get a spot on Lake Erie or a spot on Lake Michigan, you know, with that kind of quality and that kind of volume. But absent some kind of great asset like that, you know, we think this upground reservoir system makes us one of the most resilient for surface water utility of our size around. Right. We really appreciate the fact that we've got this infrastructure back there. We also, speaking of upground reservoirs, we have a great partnership with City of Columbus.
Yeah.
They have built something we call the Doubt Reservoir, named after John Doubt, a former worker of Columbus. Mm-hmm. It's over 9 billion gallons further upriver here in our county. And we have a partnership with them. We participate in the cost of that and the cost to maintain that. And we're able to acquire that water down here close to us. And we use that as part of our source that we fill up our reservoirs with too. So appreciate that as another asset we have for upground reservoirs.
Yeah, absolutely. That's your raw material and you're to keep it plumbed totally. I want to talk about technology. What does technology mean to you and how are you deploying, especially when you are such a diverse area and you cannot possibly move people around all the time because then they're just spending the time on the trucks. So what's your view on that and where you're headed on this topic?
We're always trying to get better. That's the bottom line, right? So what can we deploy that has potential to make us a better utility? We've added GPS location devices for all our vehicles, simply so we know who's proximate to an area when we have an issue come up. It can allow us to avoid a long truck roll when it could be a very short one. Our IT philosophy has been, you know, we get a very small but talented IT team. And in order to take some of the burden off of them and to rely on experts that do more specialized work every day, we've been very intentional to try to take any of our new technology deployments and move them to cloud-based. So we went to IBM's Maximo as our asset management platform back in 21. So the day we went live, we joined a group of, I don't know exactly how many, but dozens, if not hundreds of utilities around the nation that rely on IBM's Maximo So they actually have their own set of conferences and stuff related to this. So it's all maintained in the cloud, maintained by experts that do nothing but maintain these databases every day. Our team works with them and with some other experts to deploy it to our field personnel. You know, so every single one of our trucks has connectivity to the internet at all times. We do have some devices that allow us to sync up and stuff if they should lose connection here or there, but we're deploying the technology live in the field. Huge investment in geographic information system with Esri's products. Again, it's all cloud-based, but we do a lot of work from the map. You know, we told you we use Maximal, but a lot of our field-based, they actually work in the GIS and they get their work orders in the GIS and they use the map, execute them to record them, and it all goes back and stores that data so that we can make good decisions with it in the future. We just went to Oracle's customer cloud system, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. Same deal, right? We picked a really big, really expensive product, but because it's tried and true and we think it's future-proof, at least that's our expectation, is that, you know, hopefully 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, we'll still be on some new version of Oracle and it will still be providing the best product for our customer base, for our members down in the future. So that's been very intentional. Other things we've done with technology, you know, we're starting to get into the distribution system, something you spoke about before. Really haven't done a lot with it yet. We're trying to get much more intentional in how we do that. We do have a pretty robust unaccounted for water program. This is something that American Water Works, when you run through their audit program, would say, well, right, probably don't have enough water loss to invest in this. But we did so quite intentionally. We onboarded a canine leak detection animal at Kena a couple of years ago. One of your former guests, Tad Bohannon, was the original pioneer with Vessel. And we know Tad pretty well. And so that worked out pretty good. And that's a really good mascot for utility. So we've done the same thing here. And we're actually looking to try and find ways to use our expertise. Zach Lower is our professional that keeps and runs and works at Kena, and we're trying to find ways to, you know, maybe to train new dogs and deploy them to other utilities. We've had some other interest from some of the big utilities here in the state of Ohio. So we think that's a real cutting edge technology that we've deployed.
Got it. Well, excellent. I mean, it sounds like a lot. And who would have thought that you would also host canines as part of your leak detection program? But that's just the progress we are making in all kinds of spheres. I want to talk about collaboration, public trust. From what I know, you're very active in the local chamber. You actually, I think, chair the local chamber and a number of regional water groups. How are you utilizing this position of yours in terms of driving big changes and initiatives going forward at your own agency or at these other participating organizations?
Well, when I arrived here in 2012, we were very much a member-focused service organization, but we were very internally focused, right? We did very little to engage the outside community. And we very intentionally, the board kind of said, we should do this. So I've taken their direction and we've been very intentional trying to do just that. So we've become very strong community partners. So strong that, in fact, in 2022, we were recognized by both the Chamber of Commerce here and by our county foundation as the Corporate Citizen of the Year Award. So we've got a pretty good philanthropy program going forward. On the outreach side, something that was never done prior to about 2018 is we've been really focused. We onboarded, Laura Terry's actually just getting ready to retire. She's one of our associates and she's been our original outreach coordinator. So thankful for the work she's done. But we go and we serve in charities. And the one I like to highlight every year, the Friday before Memorial Day every year, we shut the utility down, you know, except for the treatment operators. You know, some folks have to be here on site still, but for the rest of us, instead of reporting here to the utility campus, we all report up to Flying Horse Farms. This is a part of the Paul Newman Camp Network for critically ill children. And we do our Camp Creator Day, right? So we show up there and we give them 3 or 4 hours work all morning long. We bring our backhoes, our excavators, our mechanics, electricians show up there and we provide them services that none of their other volunteer groups can. For those of us who don't have specialized skills like me, we'll go there and we'll help clean the bunkhouses and plant trees and do whatever else they need done. But we do that. We adjourn shortly after lunch, so everybody gets to go home a couple hours early, but they know that they've made a difference to that camp for that year that no other volunteer group can do. So we do those type of things that we've never done historically. We also are very active in the industry and very intentional. So back in 2023, we opened our newest building, what we call the Wolf Water Center. It's named after one of our original employees and our original attorney, the Wolf brothers, that kind of were our origins here. So the Wolf Water Center, the entire second floor is an event space. It can hold 120 at desks and 300 and some if you do just standard seating. But the point is, we use that to train ourselves. We also use that with our partners in the industry. So American Water Works Association, Ohio Rural Water Association, OWEA, others come and use this. It is the training hub now for Ohio. And it was very intentionally, right? We wanted to make it that. And I think we've arrived at that. It's probably hosts more water related activities than any other location in the state of Ohio. We currently employ the executive director of the Ohio section of American Water Works. I'm on the board as the Ohio secretary. And there was a change going on with the association that was managing before. And we just stepped in and said, you know, we can help the section find a way to onboard a permanent staff to be the executive director there. And we work with our townships and our municipalities, all the fire departments. You know, we coordinate with them on their flushing and everything. So I believe we are a trusted community partner. Every year we have our annual meeting of members. It happens every year. This is what a cooperative does. This is when we host our elections and we do our business. But we've turned it into more of a fair, right? So they come in early and we feed them and we do tours to drive them all back to the reservoir system, explain how our system works. We have demonstrations of hydrants, demonstrations of meters. We have a lot of our environmental team come here and show them the types of work we do on campus with pollinator gardens. And of course, the first in Ohio, the floating solar array that we have back here. And I'll talk to you about that here in just a second. But it's very intentionally, it went from average about between 80 and 100 folks, so now we're getting 500 to 600 in, right? So much different focus on community. Somewhere we want to get into the solar. We had an appetite for solar. So we've got a very engaged committee of employees that are focused on sustainability. We don't have a full-time professional for it. We've got about 120 associates total here, full-time associates, and just don't have the type of bench that allows for a full-time dedicated professional for sustainability. So we have a group that does it amongst their other job duties. And we have an appetite for solar, like I said, but we're a growing utility and it kept on getting close to the end to make the decision. And I just could not give up the 5 acres plus of ground it took to put a meaningful solar array on our campus. And saw a webinar and one of our vendors brought this to us. And we said, you know what, this is it. We can do this, right? These reservoirs are already ground that's dedicated to a purpose and this is mutually compatible. And we can get solar in here, and we're not giving up ground for the future. So that was really the primary driver. It wasn't necessarily to be the first, but we enjoy being the first. We enjoy being innovative and leading the way. So that led to this first, I think it's the first in the Midwest, but I know it's the first in Ohio, the floating solar array. So we're excited to have that here. It's a sunny day today, so I know it's generating a lot of power to operate our water treatment plant and the campus here.
Excellent. By the way, coming back to your event center, I was there, and it was fantastic. So nice and big and new construction, et cetera. It's clear to me that you build public trust, not just providing the water supply, but actually truly integrating in the community and within the peers, your peers that supply similar water. And I heard the word intentional quite a few times, which tells me you've thought about it, there's a strategy, and you're executing it. So I want to get to the final phase of my questions. What's ahead for Delco Water? And what does legacy mean for you?
Those are great questions. So we're just rolling out this inclining block rate. We're hoping to pick up some additional source, so to speak, with conservation, right? We're hoping that peak day declines. If we could get the peak day to decline just 10, 20%, that's years worth of growth when it comes down to, because we're fine for domestic supply. We're not stressed in any way, but that peak day is such a challenge for us to meet and to get water into the different areas of our system. So we got that. We've got a lot of infrastructure that's coming online now. We have three new elevated tanks that will come online in the next 2 months. The transmission line to fill those up. Some we are in progress. Some are in active construction. Some are in final design. So we have those coming online. Our next big treatment plant expansion is the Ralph Scott plant. It's named after one of our founders, and it's located at the base of Alum Creek on Army Corps-owned ground. And it's going to be a challenge for us to expand that plant. We were hoping it was a rubber stamp, and we ended up talking with the Army Corps, and they said, no, we just don't let anybody dig holes in and around our dams. It's not a rubber stamp. You need to be very intentional and strategic in how you design this thing. So we're working on picking a partner and working with the Army Corps to both extend the timeline of that lease and expand the leasehold so we can expand that plant to take advantage of source that we already have, particularly for the peak day, right? Something that's a little bit different here in the Midwest is how can we produce more water in June, July, August, then we produce in January, February, March. It's just not common. Not that the whole nation doesn't deal with that, but just not very common here in Ohio. We have a source water partnership with Columbus. We talked to you about the Dout Reservoir already. We got the next phases of those coming online. But source is going to be one of my legacies, right? I really would like to leave this utility in a place so it is enough source to last through the 21st century. This is 21st century water. I'd like them to start worrying about 22nd century water. That would be a great legacy for me to leave. And, you know, we already talked a little bit about the distribution. Like, one of the things we're talking with AquaSite about is building a model based on weather trends, based on forecast, what demand we'll have in different areas of our system, right? So we've had challenges keeping some of our elevated tanks full because the sprinkling demand is so great, we can't fill them fast enough. How do we know ahead of time that we're going to have an issue with that, using data and technology, and proactively reach out to our customers and say, don't sprinkle tomorrow, or just change something, right? That's one of our goals, right? So deploy more technology, continue to be innovative on that front, really start looking for quality, quantity, and technology within the distribution system, something we really haven't done much of. So that would be our next frontier. And then, like I said, the biggest thing of all is people, right? I've got great people here. We're fortunate, unlike a lot of utilities, we've been growing over the entire age of our utility. And so we didn't have this cliff that a lot of utilities were dealing with, like there's 15 people retiring in 5 years, right? That's just not been the case for us. We've had a couple of key employees retire, but we've not had a bunch leaving us all at once. So one of our strategic plan initiatives is individuals and teams, and we're trying to be much more specific about career paths. They're built into it to some degree, but about training and career paths, so we can really engage folks and get them ready. Also, to build the next general manager. Fortunately, I still have a fair amount of runway before I retire, but we're going to build the best team so I can leave here feeling that I've done a quality job, left the utility in a better spot than where I inherited it. And hopefully we can invest in the right types of innovation and technology and just really build a quality 21st century utility. That's what we're after. Yep. Hopefully that will be my legacy.
You laid it out very clearly. I mean, Glenn, I'll tell you what I really enjoyed. Of course, you are 35 years old. Went to Sarasota, led a group of 70, 90 engineers, led the utility there, came back home, you know, leading a cooperative through a major growth journey with 830 square miles, trying to have a source water protection and source water resiliency as your legacy, introducing a new pricing scheme that would allow your peak day, peak demand trimming, running utility with extremely low write-offs, what I can tell. Continue to make progress in the water quality front, and you're deploying all kinds of technology. Not only what you deployed now with specialists, but also what you could do moving forward. There's a whole slew of stuff, including, and not necessarily the lowest part, but how you're engaging in the community, your organization, the outreach. There are not many what I would call water growth stories in Midwest, and I think Delco is an exception here. So I enjoyed this conversation. I learned a lot, and I think the audience absolutely learned a lot what Delco is and your style of leadership, Glenn. So I want to thank you for being part of this call.
Thank you so much for having me today. I hope that the program continues to be the quality that you've had with your other guests, because I've listened to them, heard the story of New Orleans and, you know, John and Vegas and even Matt just a couple weeks ago. I know him pretty well, and you've really had a significant story for some of these utilities to tell. And I hope that they appreciate what we're doing here in the Midwest and the Columbus, Ohio region, and why cooperatives might be a good way to lead utilities in the future. And fewer, better run utilities is what I think the legacy this nation needs for better water and wastewater services into the 21st century and beyond.
Very well said. Thank you so much.
Join host and AquaSite founder and CEO Mahesh Lunani for another episode of 21st Century Water, produced by Jag and Detroit Podcasts.